I'm very excited today to share with you a man of extraordinary vision who can make a gigantic difference in your finances and also in your sense of certainty about what you can do to ensure your own freedom and your sense of security in the future. You know, you can really work at having joy, but it's not sustainable unless you really have a sense of certainty within yourself that goes far beyond anything that comes from temporary changes that happen in your life. And we all know that there are going to be changes. What I try to tell people all the time is people say, oh, I don't know how I'll deal with the changes that will come up in the future, or I don't like change. But you got to learn to love change, not just because the time that we live in, because all times are filled with it. It's just a bit accelerated in our minds now, because in the next 3 years, we're going to see a doubling of the information that humanity has accumulated in all of the history of humanity. We're seeing technology changing things more rapidly. We're about to change our biochemistries through drugs that people never dreamed of, putting devices inside of us that are going to change what we call a human. I mean, our world is about to change completely, radically, and there have been many times in human history when this has happened. Gigantic jumps, transformations, and whenever that kind of change happens, there's crisis feelings going on within people. They're predictable. And some of you have been exposed to the book The Fourth Turning, and you know that there clearly have been seasons, emotional seasons, that societies go through every 80 to 100 years, predictably so. And they're just like the seasons. And so I thought that one of the most valuable things that we could share together in the area of creating more certainty in your life, in an area where you could begin to anticipate and take advantage of what's going on, would bring you one of the most successful market forecasters of the last 20 years. Not just so you could earn more money, but so you can appreciate what's really happening and be able to take advantage of it at all levels, emotionally, spiritually, understanding how it affects your business, how to help your kids understand what's going on, community, friends, and economically prosper as well. And my metaphor that I use in life is I really believe anticipation is one of the ultimate powers. And the metaphor I try to offer people is, if you know the road ahead, you have a lot of peace. If you know the road ahead, you're going to have a lot of prosperity. If you know the road ahead, you have yourself in the driver's seat instead of in the reaction seat. And the best metaphor for that I know of is trying to play a video game against a child. What happens to your amazing talent, inspiration, skill, intelligence? It disappears, right? All your significance will disappear the minute you play a child in a video game. And the reason is because when you got that little device in your hand, you are reacting because you don't know there's a monster behind that wall and one behind this wall and coming here. So you're always in reaction to what's going on. And I don't care how smart you are. I don't care how centered you are. If you're in reaction, you're not going to be as effective as someone who knows what's coming. And those children know the road ahead because they played this game before. They know there is a pattern, and they know after this pattern, this is where it'll be, and this is where it'll be, and it gives them power. So pattern recognition is power in finance. It's power in recognizing things in a relationship, because you begin to realize what's really going on instead of getting caught up in the moment. You have a context for what's going on, and it gives you the capacity to pull a deeper, richer, and more accurate meaning. I mean, I really think the science of leadership, it's the science of influencing people to realize that we are the creators of circumstance. Sometimes we create them by being ignorant to patterns that are around us. I've always been a hunter of human excellence. People who have figured out patterns that can reveal things to us and save us enormous time, whether it be in science, whether it be in art. Most important to me in the area of human psychology or physiology, because our emotions, our finances, our bodies, these are the things that shape our lives the most. So the focus here is going to be on those things that can affect your economic well-being, but all economics are tied to our emotions. And most people make financial decisions from an emotional place, and often it's not the most resourceful one because they're in that reaction. They don't know what's coming. So in Power Talk, we have two people who have opposite predictions about what's coming. I mean, they both respect each other enormously, and they're both incredibly qualified, and they're both friends of mine and people I respect enormously and have known for years. So Harry Dent, I had a privilege of meeting back in 1991-92. At that time, if you remember, in the United States, we had a significant recession, and everyone in the society was talking about downsizing, right-sizing, bringing your world into control, shrinking spending, and people are talking about it's not worth it anymore. They don't want to be on that success track. They don't want to push for any of these things. And I was at the bookstore, and I found this book, and I'd never heard of it, and I looked at it, but the title grabbed me because I love to look at every point of view. And in the midst of all this supposed challenge, the title of the book was The Great Boom Ahead. And that was intriguing to me. Although anybody who's got that mindset, I want to know what they're thinking about. And I started to read through, and I said, this guy's an economist. He isn't some layperson. he's not just an economist, he's a one-handed economist. It's very often it's hard to find. He doesn't say, on the one hand, I think this, on the other hand, I think that. He's saying, this is how it's going to be. Second thing is, he's a successful businessman because he's been with Bain Corporation as an executive. He's consulted with companies, so he thinks like a businessman, not just an economist. And thirdly, I thought, what he's describing, as I just leaf through it, makes sense to me. And what he described in this book was that we were about, in spite of everyone else's predictions, to have the greatest boom in our economic history as a country in the United States, and that there was a very specific pattern that could predict that. That 70% of our economy, as it is today, is driven by individual spending, by consumer spending, at least in the United States. That's what's driving the whole engine. And that there are predictable spending patterns based on what stage of life somebody's in, family spending patterns. And that we're about to have the largest group of people, a baby boom, entering the highest productivity time of their life, the stage of life when the majority of them will be most productive. They've accumulated skills, talents, abilities, experiences, and they're now going to bring those to bear. They also be earning the most they'd ever earned in their lifetimes, and they'd be spending the most they'd ever be spending. And they went through with precision and showed how this would change. I was so blown away by the book, I had to find him, track him down, and interview him, which in those days was not hard to do, because they're not beating down his door as they are today, whether it be AT&T or Coca-Cola or whoever it is, investment banking firms that want to align with him. Because what he said to me at that time was, he said, Tony, look, the Dow at that time, I think when we met, was around 3,100, 3,200 in that range, if I remember correctly. And he said, it's going to go to 8,500, Tony, in the next 10 years, conservatively. He said, I believe it can go above 10,000. 10,000 at least, but 8,500 would be the minimum. And I remember sitting there as I was interviewing him going, that seems slightly optimistic, even after listening to everything else he shared with me. I mean, that's just an explosion when the Dow had gone to a huge explosion to get to 3,000. It wasn't that long before, 1978, it was around 790, just to remind everybody the kind of growth it had gone through. So everybody thought, it's exhausted. I mean, this has gone beyond anything you could ever imagine it could go. And I said, but look around at people's psychology. You know, I said, people don't have the mindset of spending. He said, Tony, that'll all change. He said, let me explain to you why it stopped here, and he walked me through the process. And I just remember thinking, this is the most brilliant synthesis that I have heard. And then I watched as everything he said came to pass. And it was not just that prediction that really impressed me about Harry, but he then wrote a book that became very popular and made him very hard to reach and talk with, because he wrote a book called The Roaring 2000s. And that book was a big success, because by that point, everything he predicted was coming true. And he started to describe how much further it was going to go, because people were still saying, God, isn't this the most it can go? And at that stage, when he did that, he had some interesting predictions, if I remember correctly. In later in 98, he said there'll be a four-month period, July, August, September, I think it was in that range, the market is going to drop 2,000 points. He said, it's up about 9,000 now. It's going to drop down that 7,000, 7,200 range. And in July of 98, it was 9,300, and boom, in no time, it was down to 7,200, 2,000 points. He said, but don't worry, it's a temporary drop. It's based on these patterns of technology and mindset and emotion. He said, it always happens. It'll be right back up again. And sure enough, by 99, it was 9,600 again. So his level of precision hasn't just been one giant leap that he's told everybody about. It's been detailed precision by understanding the road ahead, from understanding specific patterns. Your task will be not only to listen and learn, but to think critically and say, will those patterns continue based on what he's described and your belief? Because those decisions, your belief about what's being shared with you, powerfully will shape your economic destiny in the direction that you're going to make decisions, which is going to shape everything in your life. So I'm going to give you an interview I did with him in 1999, and then an update that we just recently did for our Life Mastery graduates in 2002. And I think you'll find that there is still some phenomenal opportunity for you to begin, be able to maximize your economic opportunity in any market by having a preview of what really drives the market, which is quite different than what most people are teaching. So enjoy this interview with Harry, understand the kind of accuracy he's had through time, and most importantly, afterwards, get an action plan together of how you're going to use his suggestions to maximize your own personal success. All the best. Let's begin with Harry Dent. First of all, most economists look at the economy and they understand the economy is driven by consumption. And if we look at the economy today, 68% of our gross domestic product is driven by consumers. Most people think, economists look at that and say, okay, well then consumers are going to consume based upon what's happening to inflation, what's going to happen to interest rates, what our debt ratios are. But you have a totally different point of view. You believe the economy is driven by sex. I'm saying that humorously, but it's true. Tell me, what is driving this great boom we're in right now that you predicted so many years ago? What's the driving force in it? How does the baby boom generation relate to that? And then maybe we can talk about, you know, the spending cycle that human beings go through that has allowed you to be so accurate now that I've described all this.
Well, see, the truth is people drive our economy. It's Homer Simpson, not Alan Greenspan. And to create growth in our economy, we have to create new people, and that's why sex is critical. But what happens is people do predictable things as we age. Now, we're all a little different, but if you look at average statistics, which I've been able to glean from a lot of sources in the government, average person in this economy spends the most money in their entire lifetime at age 46 and a half, just as their kids are leaving the nest. Very normal thing. Had the kids at age 27 and a half, got married 25 and a half 2 years earlier, the kids turn 19 to go to college or go out in the workforce at age 46 and a half, and you don't need a bigger house, and you start to slow down. So people do predictable things as they age. I've always said I can summarize fundamental economic trends, our economy, in one sentence. It's the predictable family spending cycles of new generations of consumers and workers. Now, not only do they spend more into age 46 and a half, they become more productive workers. I mean, to me, that's demand and supply. We spend more as we raise our families and advance in our careers and earn more money. But as workers, we learn, we utilize new technologies, we age and gain experience, we become more productive. Productivity peaks in the mid-40s likewise. That's supply. Right. That's why economy can boom and startling economists and have falling or low inflation, because supply and demand are both expanding. Now see, that's the biggest thing driving our economy, spending and productivity of new generations. We have this massive, massive baby boom generation. It's so much larger than the generations come before it. That's why they're exaggerating things. That's why we had such giant debt ratios when they bought homes in the 80s and in peak numbers. That's why we had have such an incredible economy, because they're moving into their peak spending years.
And investing years, obviously.
And investing years, just to start.
Right.
Spending goes from 19, workforce entry, into 46 and a half. Saving and investment starts in the mid to late 30s after you get your first home and mortgage, and extends all the way in the late 60s. So in the next decade, they'll be moving to peak spending years and saving, investing, throwing money at the market, since the economists say the stock market's overvalued and baby boomers haven't even started throwing money at it on the investment side. It's just being driven by their earnings and spending driving the economy. But see, even before that, other things happen. People wonder what causes inflation. I ask audiences one simple question. True or false? Kids are expensive.
Right.
Of course, everybody raised their hand. That's not hard to figure out.
Right.
Economists would never think of something like this. People drive our economy. Well, if the most productive adults are in this cycle 19 to 46 and a half spending and productivity, what about kids? If you look at kids from the time they're born, they're learning, they're growing, they're not producing, they're not contributing.
They're dependent.
They're dependent, yeah. That's right. They require huge expense and investment, not just by parents to raise. Governments have to educate them. Businesses, at the final stage, they enter the workforce on average age 19 and start this wonderful productivity and spending cycle where they right. contribute to the economy. Up until that point, they're all expensive. The businesses have to build them an office in advance, give them technologies in advance and training before they become productive.
So they got to buy computers, they got to get all the information in. And this baby boom generation was in mass. The metaphor you use is a pig going through a python, right, or going through a snake. It's so large that whatever it enters, that stage of life, all of a sudden the products that relate to that stage of life go crazy. So when a person's 19 years old and they enter the workforce, there's a huge demand, and we found this big baby boom created massive inflation, because all of a sudden we had all of this debt that had to be taken on by companies in the early 70s. But at 19, we're also, they're entering the workforce, they're getting their first apartment. Let's finish the stages of life first, and if we could. They finally get together with somebody else at what, 25? Is that what you said?
Right.
They start at 25?
Up to 19, they're innovating, creating new technologies, which is also expensive. These technologies don't pay off for a long time either.
Right.
They're entering the workforce at great expense. Then they start to become productive people, and the first thing they do is go try to get married, age 25 and a half today.
So they immediately take on more debt.
They start to take on debt. That accelerates in the next phase. But just getting married, they're forming households. I mean, now they're major consumers. We got to build shopping centers there.
Mm.
Now, looking back at the correlation, inflation peaked 19 years after the peak of the baby boom birth index because of entry of the workforce. Shopping center development
as they're
peaked.
All entering the workforce, yeah. Making demands.
Yeah.
Okay.
Shopping center development then peaked 1986, 25 years later, as they were getting married. And I'm sure apartments did too, but I've seen the actual statistics on shopping centers. Now, when we really go into debt and when we really make our biggest expenditures – and particularly in real estate, when we buy our first home.
Right.
That's age 33 for the average family. And within 1 year of that, age 34, we have the highest debt-to-income ratios in our entire lifetime. That's what created not only the incredible housing boom, starter boom, 70s and 80s. Houses went up at twice the rate of inflation for over two decades.
Because all these people had to go buy their
first
home.
All had to buy homes, drove them up. There weren't enough homes. They also had to borrow money because the inflation we just talked about, the highest mortgage rates in history, 2 to 3 times what their parents paid in many cases. They had to borrow more than their parents, borrowed in massive numbers, and that's why we got the extreme in debt ratios in the 80s. Now, see, economists think, oh, that's something wrong with our economy. No, it's just a much larger generation doing what normal people do, and yes, now they're going to be borrowing less in the next decade, investing, having higher incomes, driving the greatest productivity and spending boom in history, and instead of bankruptcy 1995, we get balanced budgets in 1998.
Right.
We get booming economy. All of this is predictable stuff because people drive our economy.
So what I'm hearing, let me see if I can recap here. 19, they enter the workforce.
On average.
On
some
average,
of us
I understand.
Later
that's the most important key. Some people are doing it at 14, you know, obviously.
Right.
Some are doing it at 30 these days.
Yeah.
So it depends on where you come from. A person roughly in their 25, they're coupling up and getting married. As they do that, they form a household. They got to go out and get appliances.
And they have kids within the next few years, most of them.
Kids. So now they got more demands that are happening in that area. Then I get my first home, my early 30s. Then I get rolled up to my second home, my early 40s. When I hit 46 and a half, the reason that the spending caps at that point is the kids are now gone. I'm not paying for college educations anymore. I've already got as big a home as I probably really want. I might downsize. I might not. But I don't have the same drive, and I may start to save at that point because I got to take care of my future.
Savings accelerates.
So what you're talking about here is that since the baby boom generation is so huge, you're saying that between now and basically the time in which the majority of these baby boomers hit their final spending, when I say final,
their peak
of spending, and that's going to happen about 2000 and...
Between late 2008 and mid-2009. The only question is whether the stock market might react a little ahead of that, which it typically does.
So when we say ahead of that, maybe a year or two ahead of that, not 5 or 8 years ahead of that, correct?
Yeah, 6 months to maybe a year or two ahead of it. The stock market may start to say, wait a minute, now we can see these demographics going, so we're not going to value stocks so high.
Here, what's amazing is in 1993, when we did that first interview together, one of the things that I asked you is, everywhere you read, in the newspapers at least, they were saying, you know, the baby boomers have really changed. They're not into consumption anymore. That's why the economy's gone down. They're all looking at a different lifestyle. They're not going to consume like they did in the 80s anymore. They don't want their BMWs. They want a spiritual lifestyle. You know, they want to, you know, be more intelligent. They want to be sages about it. And you looked at me and said, I'm sorry, Tony, but there is just no way. When these people enter that phase of life, they are going to spend like no one has ever spent before because they're so big. They're that pig going through the python. And people, not individuals, but as a group, are going to spend in mass. And they're going to create the biggest boom that ever happened. You showed that that was true as well as you could predict that diaper sales are going to go crazy when a mass number of kids, you know, all came into that particular part of the population. So my question is this. How big is this baby boom population? I mean, how large is it compared to the generations before it? And how does it compare to the X generation? I've heard it's about 25% of the size of this one. And how does that help to predict where we're going financially?
Well, the baby boom first was born in three waves. Those people who weren't consuming anymore was just the first wave already peaking out with two much larger waves to come in and consume. That's why I said there's no way we're going to see consumption go down.
Well, let me clarify that real quick because I want to make sure because I know you predicted, you know, in 89 that we'd have a recession as well. You saw that recession because you saw people being born and you looked 46, 47 years later and saw when they were going to peak out. When were those people born?
See, a lot of people don't define the baby boom correctly, at least the way we do. The baby boom started in 1936. There was a big wave of baby boomers. The first wave was born before World War II. There was a sharp dip in births during World War II. And you do that forward, you could have seen the boom of the 80s and the bust in the early 90s, but then two more waves to follow. So, yes, the TV interviews these people, and they say, yeah, we're not into consuming anymore. Well, those were people already in their late 40s after their consumption cycle, looking to slow down in life because their kids are gone. But people didn't realize there were far more baby boomers yet to come in their peak consumption cycles behind them. We saw that second wave into the mid-90s. And a smaller slowdown, which we forecast. And now we're in this massive, ever since 97, we're in this massive, largest third wave of baby boomers moving their peak spending and productivity years, and they won't stop until late 2008 to mid-2009.
So we have a time when the companies will have a chance to profit because there will be so many productive people out there earning so much money using technology to become more efficient, and they're going to have to invest to be able to take care of their future, and and they're going to have to spend. Their spending is going to cause earnings to go up for companies if they handle themselves effectively, and it's going to cause people to be throwing money into wherever they think that money is going to give the greatest return, which clearly, at least up until now, has been the stock market. What prevents them from deciding, no, we'll just do that in real estate, or, you know, let's take all of our money out of the stock market? Why would the stock market be certain to be the beneficiary of this huge amount of money that's got to go somewhere?
Well, because the stock market's so good, it's teaching people, stay with me, stay with me. And we have mutual funds and unit investment trusts and variable and fixed. And we have simple packaged products focused in sectors and style that we can easily select pieces and build a portfolio instead of having to select individual stocks. The stock market's easier to invest in than buying individual pieces of real estate. And, of course, you can buy real estate investment trust.
Sure. So you have liquidity then.
Yeah.
But, you know, usually when people talk about a bust, you know, when they say the peak of something, it's when the guy on the street corner or the waitress knows more about, you know, the stock market than somebody else. They're giving you a hot tip. And that's clearly where we are right now. Why do you say that it doesn't matter what the psychology is on the outside, that this still has to be pushed forward by demographics?
Well, first thing people should realize, people use a quote from time like 1929 and don't look at the whole cycle. We've had this 26-year boom cycles in history when generations spend. And we started this in late 82, and it'll go till about, say, 2008 plus or minus. What I've looked at past booms, about midway into the boom, stocks will transition. They'll become more popular. They'll transition to higher valuations because people realize, oh, this boom's here to stay. That's not obvious in the first half of the boom after coming out of a difficult period.
Sure.
Earnings are accelerating, come more with the technologies moving mainstream. In the later years of the cycle is where the productivity kicks in. So earnings start to accelerate. So you'll see a valuation boom.
I see.
So since late 94, not only have we been getting continued advance in the stock market, it's been going up at higher rates to move up to higher price to earnings levels, they call it. People will pay more for stocks. And the reason it's higher than in the 50s and 60s or the roaring 20s is the boom's better. Our old companies are booming with 5 billion new consumers overseas, while new companies are moving rapidly in new markets from Starbucks to mutual funds to computers and internet mainstream consumers. We've got everything kicking with low inflation rates, more powerful technologies, and a bigger generation driving the boom. So the stock market's saying, this boom looks better than the 50s and 60s did at the same time. We're making the same valuation transition, and we'll just go higher. So when the valuations rise and stocks become really popular, everybody's going to be talking about them. You know, shoeshine boys and cab drivers and stuff, and I get that every day. That'll also happen at the end of the market, but it also happens in this mid part of the cycle, and it's not a sign of danger. Demographics mean higher spending, higher productivity, falling debt ratios, low inflation, and the beginnings of the investment savings cycle of the baby boomers. Now, on top of all this spending and productivity, they're going to now throw a lot of money at the market. Why wouldn't valuations stay higher, go higher? I'm almost certain they will. Back in the late 80s, we were warning people in the mid-90s, around 93, 94, some huge watershed event's going to happen, like the assembly line.
Right, because that happens every 80 years.
Right. It happens every 80 years.
It's a technology years. Cycle,
it's
right?
It's a technology, it's a generation-based cycle, and then all of a sudden the internet emerges, and it's going to allow a new network-based business model that is the opposite of the assembly line, and it is far more efficient, far more benign for consumers, far more empowering for workers, and it allows management just to design the network and get the hell out of the way. Management is the problem today, not the solution in corporations. Reengineering creates incremental effects, but keeps you in an old business model that's destined to fail in a bottoms-up network world. So we haven't really seen the information revolution yet.
Right.
When corporations work from the bottoms up and the customers drive them and the front line people make all the decisions and the back line people just serve them as servers and make them smart, then we'll have a new world. And then customized products and computers and all types of new products will move in the mainstream over the next decade, just like cars and radios and electrical appliances, faster than everybody thought. And the average person will see their standard of living rise dramatically.
Well, the internet is an example of that because no one's running the internet. There's no CEO of the internet. And there's no giant infrastructure. Consumers are making decisions, interacting, and getting results. The way I describe it to most people is the paradigm shift that we're now, I think, entering is we used to be a culture that was sold things. Now we're a culture that buys things. And if you get in the way of trying to sell me, I know I got a million other choices. I'm going to pass you by and go to somebody else like Dell who I can say, I want this and this and this, and they'll assemble it for me, put it together, ship me exactly what I want.
To your door.
Right.
See, the thing is, we can get on the internet, and imagine when it becomes voice-activated and video conference, which is both right around the corner.
Sure.
You can look at the information you want in a product catalog or about a product, see it even 3D in color, far better than mail order catalog. You have a question, You can push a button, get a person to help you, and then they'll ship this to your door, and you never had to go to a store. Now, if you want to see something demonstrated and have fun, you'll go to stores for that. But for everyday items, we'll have them delivered to our doors. See, people are going to realize after they get over thinking computers and internet are hard to use, which is going to change rapidly, that the internet's the greatest customer, consumer convenience in history, even more than electrical appliances that automated housework and cars that gave us mobility for the personal mobility first time in life. Internet gives us the mobility to go anywhere, talk to anybody, do business anywhere, video. It's an incredible, flexible, customizing, personalizing force.
It unifies the world.
Unifies the world. The one thing you do know is that this internet's going to continue to move mainstream, and it's going to grow into consumer commerce far faster. I've already seen a startup company wants to give away very user-friendly touchscreen credit card swipe, take your picture while you're signing the credit card with a stylus on the screen. Jeez. Video conference with friends and family. You know, very simple. This machine only does one thing well. It will allow you to interact with people with companies instead of just data. If you're shopping the mail order company, you're looking around the website, getting far more information easily than you could ever get on a mail order catalog, sure, which is limited and expensive. And you need help, push a button, a person comes on. Video conferencing, ask a question. So this internet thing and video conferencing and consumer shopping is much closer than it seems. Most people say, oh, I'll never do that, and only my kids. 3 to 5 years. It's right. Going to be very,
well,
very
it's the S-curve again, as you said.
Because the browser hit.
That's yeah, because the browser.
Browser software caused it to take off. This revolution puts the information and the leverage in the hands of consumers. We've been a producer-driven society. They had to produce goods in large quantities to get economies of scale and mass production. They had to make decisions in an era of scarce information with a few people at the top, the smartest people, and pass them down a hierarchy of knowledge. And they had to shove these products down our throats. Right. We had to be manipulated, brainwashed through advertising to buy these. And that's what they do, frankly. Right. And, you know, it wasn't a sinister thing. That was the formula for the last economy. Information now is not scarce. It can be put in the customer's hands. It can be put right in the frontline person who serves them's hands. So now the frontline person needs to serve the customer.
Let's come back to financials for a second, the financial service business. I understand, maybe you know the number, that people over 50 now control some $1 trillion, and that money's going to have to be transferred over the next 20 years. Is that part of what's going to drive that industry, is the transfer of assets for people as they age, or what's really going to drive that?
Yeah, people over 50 control 77% or more of the financial assets. And the Bob
77%?
Hope generation,
wow.
You know, is peaking out, starting to die. And a lot of this money in the next 10 or 20 years is going to be passed to baby boomers. Now, we should understand, number one, this does not create new savings. Savings are passed from an older generation to a new. But when it passes that new generation, they're going to invest it differently, use it differently, and they're going to look for a different financial advisor. They're going to look for this human browser. They don't want a salesperson.
Right.
So it's going to force financial services industry to change, and it's going to put new money, old money in new hands. And they're going to invest it in Dell. They're going to invest it in equities, not bonds. And they're going to buy Dell, not Sears.
Right.
So that way, it has huge leverage. But the real leverage that's going to drive the financial services industry and cause it to grow and provide a lot of capital is that baby boomers are going to be, out of their growing earnings, saving more money in the next decade and beyond.
And investing.
So that's going to create new capital. But they're also going to get capital from their parents. So baby boomers are going to be the richest generation in history, and very soon.
Now, you know, if I remember correctly, I believe reading in one of your books, you described that in every 100 years, we only have usually one decade where stocks grow by more than, or an average of 20%. And in this 100 years, this century, we've already had two back-to-back decades with 20% returns. Is that correct? And
yeah.
Now you're predicting
if you go
a
back,
third year?
Like the 1870s was that, and in the roaring 20s.
Right.
Here we've had two decades with above average returns, 80s and 90s, and then I'm projecting almost certainly we'll see it for the next decade. Again, it's just that everything's been so exaggerated by this generation. Those booms were on generation cycles. Those booms lasted 26, 27 years while a generation spent, and then had a 14-year bust after them approximately. I've tracked this back as roughly as I can without detailed statistics. It's just this boom's so gigantic,
right,
that all the decades beat the averages, and then the next decade may even be higher than I'm forecasting, for all I know.
So the companies that we want to invest in, the companies that are going to succeed if we're entrepreneurs or we own the company, are companies that are going to be connected to the customer and are going to be meeting the customer's needs. So give me the ideal example of that type of a company. Because we keep using the word browser. I don't think everybody thinks in that terminology yet. What are they really doing? What are we really providing the customer for a company that's really going to succeed in the 2000s?
Well, let me use financial service. That's the industry I work in the most.
Right.
Wouldn't you like as a customer to have somebody come to you and say, number one, I only work with people like you in investment. You're a high net worth small business owner. I only work with high net worth small business owners. Here's the list of my clients in this area.
Right.
Why should you work with me? I only work with people like I understand your unique needs. I'm not trying to be everything to everybody. I'm a focused browser. But what's really unique about me is I'm here to represent you. I don't have any products to sell. I'm here to understand the needs of people like you. I find the best mutual funds and trust. I find the best tax and estate strategy. I work with the two best tax and estate experts I found that work for people like you. I don't work with everybody. I found the best economists to narrow down what I think you can understand and then make you a better investor. I am investing in the best sectors. I can get you insurance. I can get you anything you need, a mortgage. I'm going to integrate all these factors into a total solution for you, representing you. And I've got all these experts that I've narrowed down to back me up so you don't have to sort through them all. And you basically just pay me a percentage of your assets. I don't charge you commissions or transactions because if I did, the only way I'd make money is to trade more and buy more stuff for you and sell you more stuff. That's not in your interest, the studies show. Right. So I just have to charge a small percentage of your assets. If you like me, if you do well over time, your assets grow, I'm rewarded, you're rewarded.
Right.
Now, wouldn't you like that type of person to come to you?
As opposed to someone who's going to churn your account constantly.
Churn your account, be a salesperson, secretly be trying to get you to buy the mutual fund they make the most profit of or that their company produces. See, a browser can't be tied to the servers. That's the key. The browser represents the customer. The servers represent the choices.
Choices.
It could be specialized products or commodity products, be services, expertise. And the thing about why the browser caused the internet to take off on the software side, we already had powerful computers and specialized computers and services and databases and products. The browser on the human side is what makes the system work. We already have tons of products. How many mutual funds do we have to choose from?
More than our stocks.
How many insurance products? And then there's fixed and there's variable and there's... You know, we have all the choices in the world. Now, who's going to sift through it and help us make the right choices? Who's going to represent us? That's what a browser is. That's how it's different. It could be the same with a car dealer. Wouldn't you want to go to a car dealer that specialized only in high-end Jeeps, if that's what you're looking for, and represented all the brands and could sit down with you and say, well, what do you really need? Well, you know, for your needs, I think this brand's the best. Now, let me give you one more cut at this paradigm shift, because in different industries, it'll play out differently, and I'm gonna use financial service again. There's three models we see emerging. For large ticket items, like Dell computers that are easy to standardize or customize, sell them direct. If the customer knows enough what they want, that'd be the same for the car. If I know the car I want, a BMW 750 OIL, why not order directly from BMW, come off the assembly line, come to your door, and save the entire distribution system? So that'll happen in appliances, all types of things. Now, for a lot of everyday items or smaller everyday commodity items that we repeat purchase and buy, groceries, Walmart items, direct warehouse to consumer. That doesn't mean we go to a warehouse store. It means they'll ship to our doors after the computers measure what we buy, economic quantities, high automated warehouses. Streamline is doing this in Boston with groceries. Deliver them to your door at the same price as a retail store. Now we're skipping the retail store, but still we need a warehouse because there's many items. We don't want to buy a bar of Dial soap directly from Dial Corporation. Sure. It's not worth our time.
Sure.
But in complex services, so I mean warehouse to consumer is the second model. We see that's more Wayne Huizenga. He's got tons of cars at the everyday level. It's like a grocery store. You walk in and choose.
Exactly. And it saves all that time. Don't want to miss this. It creates a paradigm shift in the lifestyle of people because all these things they used to go spend time to that they now have time for something else. They can either waste it or they can use it to invest or they can use it with their family or have a greater quality of life.
Right. And a lot of companies get low cost by making us drive to the store, making us wait in lines, making us wait on answering machines to get the lowest cost. That's not fair. Our time's valuable too. And the more affluent you are, the more valuable it is. But the third model is this browser model. When it's more complex, like healthcare, financial services, when it has a higher impact on your life, boy, you better get a consultant to make the right decisions.
Right.
And that consultant better represent you. So in financial services, though, I think that's going to be the dominant model. I think the companies that really win in the next decade are going to be that browser server. that an online advisor, in fact, if you put on the internet, an online advisor talks to you individually but handles all these things and represents you and can source from any source of funds. But see, in financial services, all three models, Charles Schwab is a warehouse operation. Any type of investment, you can buy direct. Fidelity is, if you know what you want, you know the mutual fund you want, you buy it direct from the company, direct producer to consumer. So all three of those models are in financial services. As the baby boomers age, get more affluent, get smarter about investing, because all the studies show that a lot of trading and buying direct really isn't profitable.
Sure.
It's you know, penny wise, pound foolish.
Sure.
They're going to want an advisor, but they're going to want a different advisor. So we're saying in that industry, out of those three models, 10, 20 years from now, that's most likely to be the dominant model. People with a lot of assets go to an advisor. That's been proven.
That makes sense. Tell me what, you know, we've watched in this century a growth. It took us, what, to 1800 to get a billion people on the planet? And then this last century, we moved to 6 billion. We've added 5 billion people on the planet in this century. And most people don't realize what took 1800 years or more, I guess 5,000 years, to get on the planet. We started doing over a 50-year period, and now it's every 30 years we're adding geometrically. I think if I remember correctly, the last 30 years we added 3 billion people. They're projecting now that by 2020, 30 years from now, a little less than that, we're going to have 12 billion people on the planet. We have 6 now. Imagine doubling all the number of people on the planet. What does that do to all of these forecasts? Does it just create a much larger market to sell to, or, you know, does it destroy the planet? What's your point of view from an economics perspective, and what's your point of view in terms of understanding the infrastructure necessary to support, you know, that many people?
Well, you know, the biggest insight, if you look way back at history, extremely simple. When population grows, civilization flourishes. Standard of living rises. Population was growing from the farming revolution all the way into the Greek and Roman empires. And as soon as it started to slow, we hit the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages was a miserable time. It wasn't a time. I mean, a lot of people saying today the cure is slow down population. Population starts this whole generation cycle accelerating. More innovation by young people, more growth, more changes in business. So population growth is actually good. The thing behind it is the more people there are and the more technology they have, the more we interact. Biology is all about interaction. Interaction enriches our life, quality and quantity. The flip side of that, I mean, in other words, first insight I would have is people saying we should slow down the population to save the planet are probably dead wrong. And history is very clear on this. The flip side of that is after extended growth periods, you'll almost always see, once growth slows, the Great Plague hit after the population explosion of 1,000 to 1,200. Then you see the Great Plague. Obviously,
this
is
war.
Great Wars. Obviously, this is putting strains on the environment. The answer is not to go back and chop our own wood and live in a log cabin and move out to the country and stop using cars. The answer is the very technologies we have. Direct producer to consumer saves a lot of inventory, a lot of distribution, a lot of traveling. You just ship it straight to the customer. It saves a lot of waste. We need to understand the new technologies, the new business models, and use them to cut this waste and deal with pollution. And we are going to have to take some of our GDP, all this great expanse and wealth, and invest it back in handling pollution. Pollution is the biggest threat, probably, environmental degradation of this incredible growth. But this growth is creating innovations in everything that's reducing pollution. Even LA has lower smog levels than it had years ago. I would have never thought that was possible.
Yeah, I was reading about that also. And also, farming has changed radically. You know, it used to take, 80% of the population to feed the United States. Now we have 5% of the population as farmers,
right,
or less. So
it's actually 1.9%.
That's right, 1%. 2%, I guess, in essence. And they're feeding not only the whole United States, but the planet. And we're seeing an efficiency there where they're not using fertilizers as strongly. They're using satellites now to connect to figure out exactly what this little patch of ground needs as opposed to the patch right next to it. So, but it is interesting. If there's a disruption, though, that's severe in that area, does it affect any of this demographic argument? Because there are two arguments that I hear. And again, I started to allude to it earlier from the financial trader that I work with was, number one, if we are in a position where we just have an emotional event or we have an infrastructure event, could that disrupt people emotionally enough where they say, I want to hang on to my money and revert to the mean rate of savings they used to have, which is obviously higher than it is now. No matter how you know, argue about how it should be measured, by traditional measurements, we aren't saving. We're taking all of our money and putting it all into the markets. So the question is, if people took that money back and started saving, would that change the consumption pattern? Would we be in a position where we would not see the same growth or we would see the collapse of the market a lot sooner?
Not unless that event destroyed demographics, like a war or meteorite shower.
Okay.
What event would we need more than the SNL crisis in the early 90s to cause people to be cautious? The collapse of Japan, the second largest economy in the world, and now the collapse of most emerging countries in a short-term political crisis. People have seen all types of difficulties. A president that almost got impeached. I mean, what are we talking about? This is not going to stop Homer Simpson from getting up, going to work, getting the kids to school, earning money, saving for college. We have to do this stuff because of this cycle. And savings rates are already going to grow in the next decade because the baby boomers are going to move into a savings stage. But they're not going to do it at the expense of rising spending. Their incomes are going to rise enough in the next decade. The best cycle in the entire 80-year consumer life cycle, between mid-30s and mid-40s, people save and invest aggressively because their incomes are so high. So they're still going to spend, and they're going to save more. That's going to cause savings to rise, and that's good. That'll just provide more capital for this revolution. And get them on their way to provide, you know, preparing for retirement, all this stuff. So not unless it destroys the demographics. I mean, World War II really cut into the demographics of Japan. They lost a lot more of their population than we did. They had far more of their infrastructures damaged. Yeah. That's why they didn't have a baby boom in the 50s when we did.
Let's
they
talk about that, because I wanted to talk about that. What about the rest of the world? Let's use Japan as an example. Right now, they're in a bust. Why, from a demographics perspective?
We had a baby boom. After World War II, well,
they celebrated and had all these kids.
We celebrated. They didn't. The world looked difficult to them. They got two A-bombs dropped on them, lost tons of population. True, though, we've got the birth index for Japan. And it rose coming into World War II. It dipped. Now, almost all countries had a major dip in births during World War II. We used that dip to predict, in 89, a recession around the world, and 2 years in the United States, a down economy just from 46, 47 years. When these people came to their peak spending, there'd be a dip in them.
So what you're saying is, as we enter a wartime, people don't go around having kids. They stop. As that stopped, you can predict 46 and a half years forward and see here is the peak of their spending, and you can see the peak of the economy at that point. So you looked 46 and a half years ahead, and you went to 89 and said, we're going to have a worldwide challenge, because Europe and America both had booms for the most part. America had a bigger boom. But Asia, on the other hand, or at least Japan, having been devastated after the war, they experienced the same thing other people did during the war. They didn't go around having kids in a world that looked so bleak. So where are they now in their cycle then? Do they have a baby boom at all, or is it gone?
Well, see, like our cycle in the early 90s, almost every major country had a recession in the early 90s because of this World War II dip.
Right.
But that wasn't the end of our baby boomers. That was just a pause. That wasn't quite the end of Japan's baby boom. They had a quick surge, like most people, when the soldiers came home into 1950.
Okay.
But here's where it changed. It was from 1950 to 1957 that we in most countries had our most dramatic baby boomers.
The 50s, the good times.
The good time. Japan had a dramatic baby bust from 50 to 57.
Why?
Because the world didn't look good to them.
Right, okay.
And they didn't have as many people to have babies and all this infrastructure recovery. Whatever reasons, they plain old didn't. So 46, 47 years later, see, the first recession burst their bubble. They had a debt bubble out unbelievable, which we warned about. Right. And that burst it. Now they're falling into an extended recession, which started in 97 by demographic sliding and will continue into 2004 by our model. So we're not expecting Japan to recover, although the rest of Asia has incredibly booming demographics, stronger than the United States. Europe's in a good demographic cycle. See, they had more demographic loss in population in World War II and more infrastructure.
Than we did, certainly.
Destruction.
Sure.
So they didn't start having their baby booms till 3, 5, 7 years later in many countries. So they're behind us in the generation cycle and innovation and reengineering.
Right.
And then they're boomed. But now they're in a good spot, and most European countries will boom for the next decade, and some will boom after us, and Japan will just be getting their next generation spending when we turn down, and countries like Korea and China will have younger generation spending. So part of what we tell people demographically, most countries had baby booms like us, and most of the world moves together, but there are substantial differences, like in Japan.
Right.
Countries that will allow us to avoid them in good times. And then when we don't have good investment prospects here, we can invest in Japan and Korea and China and certain European countries, even in our next downturn, and still make money.
Why were they in an economic boom? You remember all the books on In Search of Excellence and all the brilliance of the Japanese model, right, in the late 70s when we were in such a terrible position. Well, we had all these young people basically coming into the market, usurping resources, creating inflation based on the way you describe things. Why was Japan at that time booming? Was that a generation before World War II?
Yes. I mean, they're approximately 18 years off our generation cycle.
Okay.
In the 70s, when our Bob Hope generation was declining in spending, they had a generation still rising.
Right.
So their economy was strong. They had more productive workers. They used to compete against our declining productivity workers, aging workers. They had the advantage.
So when you talk about economies booming, then you see this. This is not an American phenomenon. The booming of an economy really is driven by demographics, except, I guess, in countries where their economy is radically affected by exports or imports. Maybe you could clarify that.
Yeah. I mean, my model works the best in the United States and Canada.
Sure.
We're a very large market, all types of diversified industries. Exports are only 12% of our GDP. Well, a lot of other countries, smaller countries, or even Japan, they have like a manufacturing bias, or they focus in certain industries to compete.
Watches, for example.
Yeah, like watches in Switzerland in the past.
Right.
So they have to import a lot of inputs into that, and they export a lot to grow. So in a country like that, I have to say, well, wait a minute. They have two economies. They have their own consumer economy, which is still usually dominant, but they also have a big export economy such that even if their consumers aren't spending as much, if they're selling a lot of goods to us around the world and the rest of the world's booming, they can still be booming. Now, from my model in Japan, if it weren't for the fact that they have a strong export economy and that the rest of the world's booming like crazy, even including Asia, which we're predicting will come back quickly, they would be in a depression instead of a recession.
Right.
They would be like us in the 1930s. So Japan's export economy is keeping them from having it more difficult than this slide in births in Japan, which we show on the graph, is dramatic.
I understand that does it get worse after 2004 for them?
No, it gets worse into 2004, kind of plateaus out. Then their demographics actually turn up about 2008, 2009, just when ours will turn down.
So you take your money out of the U.S. and you start to put it in Japan.
Same thing. Our companies were getting creamed in the 70s. Large cap companies, the Dow was down, adjusted for inflation, 70% from 68 to 82. A real bear market. Japan's market was climbing in that time.
Sure.
So it'll be the same again. Their market's falling now due to demographics are rising, so it's better to invest in U.S. companies or European or Asian, but not Japan.
Let's talk specifics now. You're saying basically we're talking about 2006 to 9, somewhere in that range, because the markets will probably anticipate some of this challenge, right? So what do we do? Tell us our asset allocation, because you and I both know no single investment is going to be right or wrong for anybody. You're never going to win by making single investments. What is your asset allocation that you're recommending between now and 2009? And I asked a question earlier that I don't think I heard the answer to. Are there some bumps demographically along the way, you know, some predictable ones like you could predict in 89 or that you could predict? Because it wasn't a solid birth situation, was it?
No. Let me start with asset allocation.
Okay, let's start with that.
Asset allocation's a great investment principle because you diversify sectors that don't perform at the same times, and you can increase your returns with lower risk, you know, or reduce your risk at a certain level of return. It's a great way to invest. The problem is the theory behind it's wrong. Academics studied this over 80 years.
Right.
They said, you know, over 80 years, we found that large company, small company, bonds, and international form the best risk-return ratios in an asset allocation model.
Right.
Over 80 years. Who has an 80-year time horizon? We went through the Roaring Twenties, the Great Depression, the inflationary World War II, the wonderful 50s and 60s, the inflationary 70s, the booming 80s with falling inflation, the booming 90s with no inflation.
Right.
All different environments. In each one of those phases of our economy, two of those four sectors would have been dogs.
So you basically eat yourself up.
Yeah. Small caps and international were the dogs of the last decade. Large caps and long-term bonds did well. The next decade, we're forecasting that international is going to come back because their governments and their economies are being forced to follow our successful model, and they've got stronger demographics in many areas of the world, and that large companies are going to continue to outperform small companies because small companies do well in innovative eras like the 70s or 30s when new markets and products are forming and new generations are buying new things, and the large companies lose because their loyal customers spend less,
right?
And even though they're loyal, they lose market share to these new companies. But as these new companies move mainstream to a new generation's mass spending, you got to be large to compete. Dell used to be small, now they're large. Microsoft used to be small, now they're large. Starbucks, it's a little niche company in the West Coast years ago. Now they're a mainstream company, so it narrows down to a few leaders. So we want people to focus in large cap stocks and international. Now I went back with three criteria to find the best four sectors for a model. New sectors, not the traditionally recommended one. I wanted sectors already outperforming the S&P, makes our clients, makes investors feel better. That's easy to determine. I wanted sectors that should outperform in the next decade because of demographic trends, aging, the baby boom, and technologies. And I wanted sectors that diversified, didn't always move in the same direction. They'd make a good portfolio. Technology, the optimum portfolio I've found for the last decade. Technology, 32.5%. Financial services, obviously playing the baby boom, 32.5%. Healthcare, playing the baby boom aging, 20%. And international. Now, in this optimum portfolio, Asia came out as the best risk-return diversifier just because it runs in such different cycles.
Leaving Japan out of it.
Ex-Japan, exactly. Right. Asia, ex-Japan. And that included the 97-98 crash. It's still, that portfolio, the last 9 years would have beat the S&P by 6 percentage points with no more substantial risk. They measure risk by something called standard deviation, how volatile it is. 9.9 standard deviation on this portfolio that beat by 6 points versus only 9.6 in the S&P 500, almost the same risk level.
Wow.
So those are the sectors I recommend for the next decade. Now,
what I like about that one I just mentioned to people listening is, and they make their own decisions, obviously, is, you know, most people are when they're trying to make a decision about the future, again, they keep looking back.
Yeah.
What I'm hearing you is you're looking at where things are right now, which could be a lateral strategy, but then you're looking at the demographics to say, is it sustainable? Am I still at the front of the trend, the obvious trends, which that's fabulous. But continue, please.
Now, you can make that more conservative. You want to be more aggressive? Play the hottest sectors, technology, financial services.
Right.
You want to be more conservative, instead of Asia, put in more Europe, or put in multinational Dow-like companies that are growing overseas. They have very good returns for their risk, much less volatile than Asian markets. Convertible bonds or high-income, low-volatility stocks. So that's a starting point. The point is you want to be in good sectors that diversify, not bad sectors, as most portfolios would have put us in.
Right.
And these sectors, I think, intuitively for most people, the baby boomers are just starting to save and invest. Financial services has already beat the S&P 500 substantially in the last decade. What do you think the conclusion is? Very high chance it will as much or more in the future. So
So you don't have any bonds in that asset allocation?
No
at all.
Bonds. Zero bonds.
And the reason is?
The reason is the principal investing is you systematically invest. You systematically add money. You don't try to time the markets, jump in and out. It also says you can systematically pull money. I mean, how often does the stock market go down? Once every 4 years, 10 or 20%. It's mostly up. So you're pulling money out. You're not a loser.
Right.
Systematically pull out. If you want more income, buy high income, high dividend stocks. Buy convertible bonds that have an equity kicker.
Sure. So you have a chance to really ride the growth. Okay, so far what we're hearing here is it's an amazing decade ahead of us. And what's so exciting when people read your book, which I really want to recommend, don't just listen to this interview, but really go pick up the Roaring 2000s and read it, because there's so much there. And I think it's put in a way that you can sit and absorb it and begin to utilize it in your own life. But one of the things that we have to look at there is, are there going to be any bumps along the road? I want to follow back up on that. Are there any natural places like the 89s or the 93s because there's a dip in the birth rate? Or is there another factor? Is there anything that we need to be prepared for between now and 2007, 8, 9?
There are always things, you know, the next political crisis or the next problem in the Mideast. See, the thing is, we have to understand what we can predict and what we can't. And,
right.
and I show in this book, we can predict all the things that really count. I mean, everything. But there's a lot of things we can't predict. You can't avoid those. You can't be out of the market with demographics like that. So what I tell people, if you could tell me which industries when, oh, maybe. The better way to understand it, if you got a market like this, you don't have to avoid corrections. Nobody's been able to forecast corrections consistently.
Timers are wrong.
Yeah, timers have always been wrong. So the way to understand corrections is they're going to happen. So what you do when a correction hit, we know the sectors we like long-term, healthcare, technology, you know, financial services, Asia, internet, you know. Every correction hits one of those sectors or two of them much harder than others. Asia got cremated in late 97, early 98, was down 60, 70, 80% country. We said, buy Asia, outside of Japan, best demographics in the world. This is not going to be extended.
Because the long-term trend is going to continue.
Long-term trend. Buy. 98 hit technology a lot harder than it hit the Dow. Dow was down 20%. Technology stocks were down 33, 34. Buy technology. In other words, you already have this portfolio. When a correction hits one sector harder, lean more towards that. Buy more of that with new money, or switch from your best sector of the past to the sector that just got hit. And these are all going to go to the same targets long term, roughly. Anytime you can buy more of a sector at a lower prices, you've leveraged your long-term wealth. So that's the way to play corrections. In more volatile segments like technology or Asia. Asia has great returns long term, but it's far more volatile than U.S. markets.
Sure.
The more volatile the market, I only want to buy when they're down. because there's always good stuff to buy. I mean, sure. I'd rather, you know, in a normal correction, in a, I'd rather just buy more financial services or something like that, or healthcare is the steadiest.
Sure.
But if, you know, Asia really gets hit, I'll buy a little bit of that. And then it gives you some diversification.
That's great. So tell me, what do we do as we start to get close to, if you're saying 2008, 2009, at the literal level, where do we start to get out of the market and how do we transition out so that we take advantage of the boom time, but we don't go with the bust?
Right. Well, number one, we don't get out of investing ever.
Right.
Not investing or having cash under your pillow is stupid. What we do is we have to shift all our strategies the opposite. The shift that's going to occur between somewhere like 2007, 2009 into 2020, it's going to be a down economic cycle. But on this 80-year cycle, it's going to be deflationary like the 30s, not inflationary like the 70s.
Okay. So it's a the way you've described it is actually a depression, am I correct?
Depression-like. Now, not as extreme as the 30s because of growth around the world and the demographics aren't quite as extreme on the drop side. But it's going to be significant. I mean, it's 15% unemployment or higher would not surprise me at all at the worst.
So people who are alive today would probably have never had any experience of an economy that severe in their lifetimes.
That's right. They wouldn't have. It'll be worse than the 70s, but not probably quite as bad as the Great Depression. Now, what the cycle says you'd invest in that time, and I'm going to give you a progression as this thing unfolds.
Okay.
The Dow's at 40,000, let's say, and all these large caps. The Dow has a price earnings valuation of 35 or 40, and it's out the wazoo. But these stocks, these large company stocks, will have done well for 26 years now. Nobody's going to want to get out of them. Nobody's going to believe they can go down. You got to shift from these large cap equities systematically. Let's say from 2007 into 2009.
Correct.
Systematically, start shifting more. And if the market gets really crazy, do it a little faster. It goes way up on the upside. Or shift from large cap equities into long-term bonds, high-quality government and corporate bonds, which by then probably be Dell bonds, was General Motor bonds in the late 20s and early 30s. Because the strongest leaders will survive this downturn.
Sure.
And be able to, just General Motors made a profit every year. The Great Depression only expanded their market share, actually,
Coca-Cola.
Despite a bad economy. Coca-Cola. So high-quality bonds. Two reasons. When deflation sets in, interest rates are going to fall. You've locked in rates at higher rates. You not only give yourself income in a difficult time when you'll be glad to have it, your neighbor's stocks will be falling and their real estate, but your bond will actually appreciate as rates go down if you go 30 years out in a, in a treasury. So bonds are the first. The second reason you start with bonds, when the world starts to fall apart, there's this thing called flight to quality. Nobody wants to touch anything risky or equity. Everybody wants to own bonds and in the best, you know, U.S. government bonds or Dell bonds in the world. So you get two benefits there. Now, as the world reacts, when the United States and many countries are down and earnings are down and we're falling in recession, all of a sudden the world will turn around, just like with Japan today doing bad while doing well, and say, wait a minute, Japan's economy's not slowing. They're doing okay. South Korea's doing pretty well. China's still humming, parts of Europe, and these countries will start to see, well, God, we reacted to the world crisis, but, you know, it's not so bad for us as the United States. They'll start to come back. So when those countries get hit, you can start putting some of that bond money into equities into developed countries. You don't want risky emerging countries yet. Developed countries that still have strong demographics. And South Korea be the best. China, Japan will be humming then.
Right.
And I'd have to look more in detail at Europe, but there'll be some European countries, like Spain, I think, that'll still, and Portugal, still have strong demographics.
Right.
Then the market gets worse here. Let's say it's down 20, 30% the first hit. Comes down, next thing you know, like 32 or 74, the markets are down 60, 70, 80%. I would guess 70 in this next downturn. What you want to do there, and nobody will want to do this, nobody want to go into Japan after it's gone nowhere for a decade.
Sure.
You got to buy small company stocks. Off periods, 1932 to 46, from the bottom of the 32 crash all the way through World War II, small company stocks and that rebound from the bottom outperformed large company stocks.
Really?
6-1 in cumulative returns.
Wow.
So again, this asset allocation
this is
model says,
this is domestic you're talking about. Small companies domestic, not Japan. You're talking about here locally. When you're going overseas, you're looking at big companies, though, at that stage. Is that correct? The big companies that are overseas, the largest?
In the developed countries, still growing, yeah, because
right.
They still have demographics, and you want safe, large companies, and they'll have the advantage. But in this country, a new generation will be buying new products, the Echo Baby Boom, you know, or whatever, from these new small companies. They'll be doing great. 6-1 over 14-year trend.
So let's talk about that. I've been reading recently about the Echo Boom. Again, these are kids that we're saying are born basically from 75, is that correct?
1975 into 1990.
Right, and it'll continue for a bit still.
Yeah.
So these kids are now, you see Levi's, you know, here are some standard brands that the boomers have lived by that are going through the floor, and there's some of these new brands that are coming up that the kids are going crazy over. Are they now bonding with a brand that we might want to be investing in now? And are those the kinds of companies you're talking about that in 2007 we'd be looking at, these new upcoming small companies that the millennium yes. generation or the boom echo are now going for? Is that who you're talking about?
Yes, they'll be driving the boom that follows this great boom. Okay. Not as strong, but it'll still be a great boom. And they'll be rising.
Not as strong because they're a little smaller.
Right, that's okay. right, because they're a little smaller relatively. But they'll be rising in their patterns and influence. The new companies will start to appeal to them and then mushroom in the next boom and become the next large caps. That's why you want small companies in the off periods and large companies more in the extended the boom. So the leading edge of this echo baby boom are just starting to enter the colleges and the workforce. They're just these young people, you know, setting the trends and stuff. And it's true, yeah, they don't want to buy the same jeans their parents bought. I don't care what Levi's did. The only way for Levi's to succeed with these new people is to spin off a whole different brand name and look like it's not connected to Levi's and have a whole different image and whole different people. Because these people have to differentiate themselves and rebel from their parents. That's what kids are supposed to do. Every generation reacts to the one before it. That's why individualists are conformists. These echo baby boomers that I've seen, and I have one myself, far more disciplined, far more purposeful, thinking in the future, planning ahead, want to be successful, want to get in the best careers, want to do good in school. SAT scores are now rising with them. Crime is going down. They're the next Bob Hope-like generation.
Right.
So they're going to be different from the baby boomers. And even the Generation X, they were just the declining tide of the baby boom generation.
Right.
They were the same individualistic generation. They reacted to baby boomers' idealism and certain traits in them, but they were just like them. They're individualistic, want to do their own thing.
They're more pragmatic.
Even accepted and extended a lot of the brands.
That's true.
This next generation is going to start a lot of new brands and a lot of new companies, and that's another way to invest in that way. They're just going to be moving into commercial real estate now, apartments and shopping centers in another 3 or 4 years. So in real estate, while the baby boomers are moving fastest into vacation homes and a lesser degree in trade-up, they're going to be moving in apartments and shopping centers. So you can play both those markets. I know in high-growth areas and high-immigration areas like California, young people can't get apartments. There's not enough. They've been in downturn for years. All of a sudden, the echo baby boom needs apartments. There's not enough space, and the apartment owners are very picky about who they let in. You almost got to be a millionaire to rent an apartment now.
Sure, sure. And the X generation before them has developed a reputation that these apartment owners don't like.
That's right.
Now, what will it really be like for somebody as we convert into this declining prices and where we have deflation, where you have a depression? You know, give us your picture. What does that really look like for people? If they're well prepared, what does it look like? If they're not well prepared, what does it look like?
If you're well prepared, you'll do even better in a downturn.
Why?
As an
Why
investor,
do you do better?
I would rather have a downturn than an upturn.
Why?
Stocks and investments go down faster in downturns than they go up in upturns. Opportunities are created faster. More millionaires per capita in history at any time were in the Great Depression.
Right.
So for the smart, for the people who see the changes coming, change accelerates. Now, here's the problem. Most people just going along in life are stuck in careers or stuck in companies, their own or others, stuck in investments like equities that devalue very quickly and their life falls apart. And by the time they react, it's too late. They've lost most of their wealth. They've lost their job. And they're so busy reacting, they can't respond. In this era, new investments will do well. If you've got capital, think about this. Prices are going to fall.
So we've covered so much territory, and I really appreciate you taking so much time. It's been fascinating. Let's see if we can do some summary here. You've given us a great strategy on having the right kind of asset allocation, what sectors to be focusing on. It's different than traditionally what we hear about in asset allocation, but you've described why. The cycles, two of the four that we'd normally be looking at in terms of sectors, would be cutting our profits immensely. You've walked us through what we would do to make the transition. If we're going to take all of this together and we're understanding that demographics is driving this, that consumption is driving everything. The economy is consumption, and consumption is predictable through time. There may be moments of fluctuation. There may be six-month periods of fluctuation based upon fears or economies or challenges or inflation or interest rates. But the long-term trend is your friend. If you stay in front of that wall of water, that giant wave, you're going to win. The question, I guess, is if we were going to summarize this into a couple principles, what do we need to focus on? What do we need to think about? What needs to be our guiding, organizing principles in the most simple terms if we're going to be incredibly successful and, as you say, build the wealth and lifestyle that you desire, the greatest boom in history?
Yeah, we put lifestyle in there on purpose. That's where it should start. Money is a means, not an end.
Right.
I thought The Millionaire Next Door was a great book for revealing that millionaires are a lot different than most people thought, but I thought it was the worst possible lifestyle you could possibly aspire to. It's down in the survival stage of Maslow's hierarchy. It's not in the self-actualization stage. In this era of expansion, in this era of technologies allowing you to live anywhere, work differently, make more decisions, have more control of your life, even in a corporation that works from the bottom up, or to start your own business, you need to sit down now and say, where do I want to be in 10 years? 20, 32, but 10 years at the top of this boom, a critical transition point, where do I want to be? Do I want to move from a corporate job to having my own business? What type of business do I want to be in given this downturn? Maybe I want to be working in a resort area, selling ice cream in a resort area, or building resort homes or something. I want to do something that's with the trends.
Right.
But what do I want to do? Where do I want to live? Where would I live if I could once my kids leave the nest? That's 10 years away for a lot of us towards the top of this boom. So start with lifestyle. What do you really want to do? Do I want to be a communicator? Do I want to start a nonprofit foundation with all my wealth instead of just accumulating more and buying more houses?
Sure.
You're going to see the biggest philanthropy movement in history as aging baby boomers move out of their career stages, as all this affluence is created, as Michael Dell wakes up one morning when they're kicking him out of his company because they say, we need new management and you're too much, you know, you won't change, da-da-da-da, and thinking, what do I do with my $50 to $100 billion?
It's going to be a whole slew of dead turns.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, think about the benign people, you know. Who would have thought the Rockefellers, Carnegies, Mellon, these titan, you know, blow up the competitors, Scrooge-like people, build wealth and know, you know, would turn into great philanthropists. So, I mean, that's part of it, too. What do you want to do to contribute to the world? I mean, how could you optimize your talent? So, number one, you need to consider that and get a mentor or coach to get straight on that. That's more important.
Anybody you might want to recommend?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That comes first. Resources give you the ability to do that, the flexibility, the freedom. That's what money is, freedom to do what you want or to serve society in the way you want. Then you say, well, here's what I want to do. What am I going to need? How do I need to position myself in these long-term trends, in large cap equities in these sectors? And what can I reasonably expect to earn? You know, I've already got my target of what I think I'm going to be worth in 10 years, and I don't think I'm going to be far off.
Right.
I may be underestimated, if anything. Well, gosh, if I could have this much resources, well, I could start a business. Actually, if I put all this returns I'm getting into a charitable foundation instead, or a charitable remainder trust, and didn't get taxed, I might have twice as much wealth, enough to pay me a salary out of my foundation, and have resources to contribute to society. So the second thing is, once you get a mentor to get straight about lifestyle, get a mentor to get straight about finances. This stuff of doing it yourself, e-trading, is a bunch of bunk. Number one, if you've got quality of life and time, if you got a life, you shouldn't be doing it yourself,
sure.
Even if you could. It takes discipline. It takes systems. An advisor can be systematic and take the motions out. An advisor can bring in all this estate and tax, let you know all the options. You don't know all the options. So build your wealth systematically. We've laid out the long-term trends. This is not hard. Invest systematically. Don't jump in and out of the market. Don't think you can make all these investment decisions. And even if you had the time to, wouldn't it be better to pay somebody 1% of your assets, a minor fee, to free you up to spend more time with your family or to create these goals or to start your business now on the side or whatever? So, I mean, that's what we see. Lifestyle, systematic approach. Find a good financial advisor, somebody who works with people like you, understands people like you, somebody who is objective, is a browser, can integrate the entire thing and handle this for you, somebody you trust. That's not the typical advisor out there. That's going to take some work.
Right.
And more baby boomers are going to demand that, and more advisors are going to become that. But if you get straight on those two things and leverage this boom, you're going to have a lot of options you wouldn't have thought of 10 years from now, and you're going to be positioned to take advantage of this downturn and falling prices and new opportunities.
So the summary is really clear. Number one, get in front of the trend. And if there's anything that's come out of this, hopefully for you, is a great vision of where things are going long term that's predictable, not only in our own economy here in the United States, but in any economy where there are a general broad range of services and products. And so if we can look at where the long trend is, get in front of that trend, be specific, be systematic, have an asset allocation that makes sense, and get some quality coaching, as you said, we can enter into the downtimes and have the downtimes be an uptime. And that's what really we want to do here. And this is all about anticipation. The power in life is the ability to anticipate. When you can anticipate where things are going, you have the total advantage. When you react, then you pay the price. And so I'm really grateful to you, Harry, because you have presented to us such a clear, concise, and simple approach, but profound knowledge, I believe, has always taken the complex issues and make them simple enough so that we can really use them. And you've done a great job of it. I want people to take advantage of every service they possibly can with you, and I'm sure they're hungry for that. First of all, I want to make sure you go pick up The Roaring 2000s once again, promoting the heck out of this book because it's so simple and clear and easy to use. But also, I'm sure after listening to this, you'd probably like to be in touch with Harry through his newsletters and some of his other work. So how do people reach you? What internet site can they order these types of products from?
HSDent.com, internet site.
How does it feel, and you're a very humble man about it, but how does it feel to come from the position where people thought you were wacko, in essence, I know that's a real technical term for the description, in those early 90s, and to be in a position now where most of the large investment firms have you come in and be a speaker and communicate? I know you've got everybody from the AT&Ts to the Coca-Colas that you're consulting for now. How does that feel, number one, and where do you go from here?
Well, it feels great. It's just stressful. I get more tired. The most stress, and I've been the most tired in the last 3 or 4 years, because we got the spinning wave indicator in 1988, and I published my first book in 1989.
Wow.
And it takes so long for a new concept to catch on. So yes, it is. I'm a victim of my own tool, forecasting tool. But when it finally took off after the great boom ahead, see what happened? The markets took off in 95, and so did my career. All of a sudden, I had instant credibility. Everybody wants me to speak. But my life has been running faster than I can keep up with since.
Right.
So now I'm trying to focus, which you always have to do in life, and get down to the things that really count, really create a difference. And I'm planning my life 10 years ahead. You know, what business am I going to focus on? And I've got my own nonprofit foundation I'm building. I pretty much want to drop out in 5 to 10 years, even before the boom,
wow,
and just work on nonprofit communication, which
That's
could
wonderful.
Take a lot of forms. And I haven't been able to plan my career other than general vision too far in advance in the past, so I don't try to plan it too far either. I think you really just have to be vision-driven. I've found one of the secrets to success in this age, that executives and entrepreneurs and people who overly plan every detail out for 10 years miss all the opportunities.
Right.
There's so much opportunity. Just have a vision. Know where you're going. Know your focus. Know the brand you're building.
And as be we able were talking to change earlier. Quickly.
But be able to change and jump on new things. Don't think your career's got to go here. I was all wondering years ago, gosh, it's taken forever for people to understand this simple principle, you know, and then all of a sudden it takes off and opportunities came that I wouldn't have suspected.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, good thing I didn't overplan this. And let it be, put out your energy, have vision, stick on a system, but be willing to change the system.
How do you want to be remembered? That's the question I like to ask people. You're a very young man to ask this question of, but what do you really want your work to do for people's lives? Why did you do all this?
Well, I think my biggest thing, and my books always have a chapter hidden in there, like chapter 9 in The Roaring 2000s. I'm into evolution. I'm into raising the quality of life of people, helping people evolve. We're not what we were centuries ago. The average person has far more intelligence, far more open-mindedness, much higher quality of life than they had. And I'm in, I think, much like you. The real opportunity today is moving not just self-esteem. People used to just be happy to belong and have a good job and a good family community. And then they got into, wow, I can be rich, have a nice house, have a good profession, live life the way I want to. The real next stage is self-actualization.
Okay.
And I'm into helping people move into that stage because there's obviously people have done it. There's obviously things that happen there and you don't just... You need to achieve. I mean, I'm not against self-esteem. You need to achieve success and skills in life and resources to really be able to do what you want in life and really be able to contribute the most to society. And there's predictable things that happen there. And I'm actually getting more interested in people like Ken Wilber, people who've studied spiritual traditions and evolution than I am in studying economics now.
Right.
Because new advances in technology actually force us, by automating what we used to do, forcing us out of jobs and skills and lifestyles and even family structures we used to cherish, and force us to move to something higher.
Right.
And then when we get to that new high stage, we say, oh, how could we ever lived back there? I mean, one of the things we stress in all our books, the good old days weren't so good.
So we're living in the greatest time to be alive if we use our resources.
Yeah, and if we move ahead.
Yes.
One of the reactions is to retreat. You know, just like, oh, population's growth's got to slow. We got to move back to the country and live simple lifestyles and live in a trailer and have a cheap car. That's why I don't go with the millionaire next door philosophy. No. Move ahead. Raise your level of consciousness. You know, become a greater person, a better person. The thing I hate about history, absolutely want to destroy, is the fact that people with higher skills and money and power throughout history have largely exploited people with less skills and power. That's ridiculous. Would we do this to our own kids or friends? But we do it to people. We've done it to animals. So I really feel like that's the next stage, that the best baby boomers here, rising in affluence, are going to have an opportunity to start this kind of movement in philanthropy.
Right.
That says, hey, we can succeed, have a great life ourselves, and make life greater for other people. We have unique skills, we can contribute. Nonprofit organizations, more than they need money, need management systems and vision, because they run so poorly and so inefficiently because they have idealistic people involved. So I just see huge things happening in the next decade or two, and I'm starting to get more interested in that side of things. I'd rather be known for establishing a great nonprofit foundation than being, you know, the most accurate economist in history or something.
That's awesome. Well, I'll look forward to being a sage with you through the years.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
that's the direction we all have to head. And I think you're right. I think the more secure people are financially, the more they're no longer living in fear.
Yeah.
And when you don't live in scarcity, when you don't live in fear, when you have a sense of certainty about your future, you're able to live at a higher level and contribute at a higher level. And I think hopefully your vision will give people the choice to make that happen for their lives. So thank you so much.
This session continues on the next CD.
Now, that was the interview I did with Harry in 1999. Let's get an update from him now based on 2002. There's a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace. Listen to Harry as he coaches some of our Life Mastery participants on what they need to do to maximize their opportunity today.
Hi, this is Harry Dent. Good evening, everybody. I'm going to do a presentation today called The Buy Opportunity of a Lifetime. People that are not that familiar with me, I wrote a book called The Great Boom Ahead in late 92, then another book called The Roaring 2000s in early 98, and then a follow-up to that on investing, The Roaring 2000s Investor in 99. I think the important thing, just to summarize, that I have a very different approach to economics. We use demographics, a very simple, people-oriented, scientific approach to forecasting where the key trends are that are going to affect your life, your business, your investments, pretty much decades in advance over the rest of your lifetime. This is something that economists do not think is possible, but of course we've seen that it's very, very possible because people do predictable things as they age. Now, what we found is that all of the key economic trends, when the economy is going to grow or decline, when we're going to see inflation or disinflation, when there's going to be borrowing cycle, investment cycles, basically anything that really affects the economy, these things are driven not by the government, and at least in a democratic economy with a well-developed market system like ours, it's generated by people. People drive our economy with the predictable things they do as they age, so that we have one simple leading indicator, and it is very simple, how we create new people. The birth index, which we adjust for immigration, or as I always joke, basically it comes down to sex. And if economists ever actually had sex, we think they'd understand a lot more about the economy. But we have these generational cycles. A book called Generations has documented generation cycles about every 40 years back to the 1500s. The Bible quotes generation cycles about every 40 years back thousands of years ago. So new generations come along, some larger, some smaller. The baby boom is extraordinarily large. And these people, these waves of people, grow up and do predictable things as they age. Now, the key things that affect our economy are things like when we spend money. And we know exactly when the average person spends the most money in their entire lifetime. That's age 47 today. And it's moving forward about a year every decade, as most statistics I will quote here tonight are doing. But it's not just spending. Spending creates demand in economics as people grow up, enter the workforce about age 20. They earn and spend more money as they advance in their careers and raise their kids until about age 47. But what creates supply is productivity. The same generation are not just the consumers, they are the workforce, and people get more productive as they age into their mid to late 40s as well. So one of the paradoxes that have really it's caused economists a hard time is their theories say that, well, if we grow too fast in the economy, then we'll get inflation because supply can't keep up. But we show that over the long term, when a generation's spending more, they're also producing more as workers, so that you get booms like this one since the early 80s, where we get a growing economy and falling inflation. Again, supply is expanding with rising productivity, demand is expanding as people earn and spend more money. So we know when people spend money, when they're most productive as workers, when they borrow the most money, when they save and invest the most money. These are the type of things that drive our economy and the stock markets and everything else. These are the fundamentals, far more important than short-term shifts in interest rates and things like that by the Federal Reserve. And the truth is, they only react to the trends that we as people create. Now, another important trend is inflation. Very important. It drives the bond market. It also has a major effect on the economy and the stock market. And economists aren't even in the ballpark of understanding what causes inflation. One thing you see throughout history is we do get major inflation periods when there are major wars, like the Civil War or World War II or World War I or something like that. What happens in a war is that you have a huge expense, a huge investment in the short term that does not produce the normal consumer goods and productivity that when we're working because it goes to the war effort. So expenditures go up, but goods go down, and so prices go up. You get inflation. The truth is the same thing happens in any inflationary thing. It's about high expense, high investment, low productivity. And basically, when we go back and take the same approach we always do to human causes of these trends, you could ask yourself very simply, who are the most expensive, least productive people you know? And of course, if you're honest with yourself, you'd say it's your kids or at least other people's kids. Young people cause inflation. They are expensive to raise all the way to the point that they enter the workforce. Parents have to fund raising these kids. The government largely funds the education. And then businesses have to make a huge investment when they first enter the workforce to incorporate them, to give them office space, training, equipment, computers, things like that. Only then do people start to become productive workers. So it is that it's young people entering the workforce that causes inflation. And when we finally exit the workforce, that causes disinflation or deflation. But if you look at inflation, when the baby boomers were entering the workforce in the highest numbers in the 70s, we had the highest inflation rates in U.S. history. Well, guess what? When we exit the workforce in the highest numbers between about age 2010 and 2023, we are going to see deflation. An actual drop in prices for the first time since the 1930s. So again, you can see how if we understand when people spend, when they're productive, when they buy their houses or any product category, when they borrow money, when they invest money, when they cause inflation or deflation, then we can literally project the fundamental economic trends that will affect, again, not just our investments, but our business and our life and even our kids and their lives and careers decades in advance. So again, one of the points we're going to make today, this boom is not over. There's nothing greater than to get a huge correction like 1987 or this correction when the boom is still going on. This creates the greatest buy opportunities and investment opportunities, and this is not the point of view you're hearing on Wall Street today. Everybody's saying we've seen a bubble, the stock market is going to either grow at very low levels, returns 4, 5, 6, 7% for many years, or we're going to see a continued decline like Japan in the 90s. Both of these points of view are wrong from the fundamentals. Baby boomers are going to continue to spend. So again, you can see how we can see trends decades in advance. This boom's going to continue until about 2009. Not only with economy turned down, but with the retirement of baby boomers in massive numbers, we will see deflation in prices. We can already forecast not just what the next decade is going to look like, and it's going to look very good, continue to look good, but what the decade after that is going to look like, and it will not be good. I will tell you that today. It will be a time like the 1930s that followed the Roaring Twenties. It will be a depressionary environment. You have to build your wealth. You have to switch your investment strategies by 2009 to not lose the wealth you've built up. And that's what most people did. Most of the gains of the 50s and 60s boom were lost in the mid-70s in that crash. And, of course, the markets didn't come back. So, again, We're going to look at what you can do in the near term today, but we'll also look at what you can do long term to protect yourself. Again, what we see is about every 40 years a new generation. Peak in births 1921 for the Bob Hope generation, peak in births 1961 for the baby boom, and we may see a faint peak in the Echo baby boom early in this decade, about every 40 years. We'll look at later, I mean, that causes a boom and bust cycle, but we'll look later at how every other generation, like the baby boom, this one, or the Henry Ford generation, two back, about every 80 years, we get radical innovations when that generation's young that lay the foundation for a whole new economy. So two important cycles, 40-year boom bust, 80-year new economy cycles, and then, of course, we can predict all types of trends on inflation or house buying or financial services or any industry you're in within those cycles. Now, the spending wave. This is our most important indicator. We've had this indicator since 1988. In the late 80s, we were forecasting that the United States was going to see an incredible boom for the next two decades. The Dow was going to go to 10,000 plus. Inflation was going to fall to near zero. And Japan was going to decline in the 90s. Because, see, they did not have a baby boom generation, and their spending wave was pointing down. So this is the key tool we've used for many years to simply tell us when's the economy going to boom and when's it going to bust. How long is this boom going to last? How strong is it going to be? In what basic years is it going to be the strongest? The boom that started in the early 80s, as baby boomers continue to spend on a 47 and ultimately a 48-year lag a decade out, is because it's moving forward, the economy will continue to boom into about mid-2009. That's approximately when this boom will peak. Now, you got to give about a year either way on that. But again, we've been saying for a long time, we can tell how long this boom will last. And the boom does not end until the generation is through spending. Any crisis you have along the way, a terrorist crisis or a Fed overreaction or any other political factors or an overexpansion in this industry or that industry that has to be worked out, like this tech thing here, those things will be temporary. This tells you how long the boom will last. Also note that we will see a downturn from around mid-2009 or 2010 into about 2023 because there simply will not be enough baby busters to sustain the spending on everything from housing to cars and computers that the baby boomers have. There is no way the government can prevent that downturn. Economists say, well, they can lower interest rates. Well, that's what Japan has done for a decade, and they are still in a downturn. They have zero interest rates. We had the lowest interest rates in U.S. history in the 30s and early 40s when we were in the Great Depression. So it's not that that government stimulus doesn't help, but it will not fully stop a downturn. So we can prepare for that today. You do not want to be in the stock market. You don't want to own housing that's unnecessary to you at a time like that. Yet you could buy bonds and sustain your net worth and continue to grow at 6, 7, 8%. Lock in gains just when you're getting near retirement and need to lock it in anyway, and preserve your wealth in that downturn. So I'm not going to get into that in depth today. We do that in our books. But we recommend when the season changes, just like in the early 80s when we went from an inflationary recession season to a booming disinflationary season, we will go to a busting deflationary season around 2009, 2010. You can go into high-quality corporate bonds. Large parts of Asia will still be booming. China, Korea, Japan will finally be coming back with a late baby boom there, an echo baby boom. Asia will be a place you can be. And then, you know, a lot of value sectors and defensive sectors, things like drugs and healthcare. Baby boomers will be retiring in unprecedented numbers in that decade. So there'll be sectors you can invest in real estate and in stocks, but generally you want to be out of the growth sectors. But in between now and then, we see a continued boom. Now that brings us to the Dow channel. And we've had this for many, many years. While we are in this booming demographic growth time, the stock market, you know, always goes up and down and gets overvalued and undervalued, but it's really been following a pretty clear path. It's been growing about 15, 16%. In 87, we hit the top of this channel, had a more severe correction, tested the bottom of the channel in 90 and 94 before we saw the next great surge where stocks did so very well. Well, we were warning in early 2000 that we were hitting the top of this channel and we were due for a correction. We figured we'd test the bottom of the channel in 2002, We ended up testing it with the terrorist crisis in late 2001, in September 2001. Now note that the market bottomed right at the bottom trend line of that channel. That was an extreme buy signal for us in September, as well as the NASDAQ hitting its 98 lows at 1350 to 1400. That is along with a lot of oversold indicators told us that that was very, very likely a bottom and the buy opportunity of a lifetime, which I'll get more into. We're going to see more opportunities for this, we think, over the next year. This continues to project, and we have not changed our projections. We've had this since 1996 or 97, calling for a $35,000 approximately at the top of this boom. It still projects a $35,000. And with the market down so much, it means the average annual returns we're projecting will be about 21% on the Dow buying here towards the bottom of the channel instead of the normal 14 to 16%. So this correction has just given us much greater potential returns if we're willing to get back into the large cap growth stocks that have done so well and are dominating this boom. So that's the basic boom bust cycle. This boom started in late 82. The spending wave would have predicted that. Will peak around 2009, give or take a year, before trends go down. That would say with the trends that the Dow should hit about 35,000, almost four times what it's been, you know, right here recently. 21% average annual gains for people who are in that market. Again, we'll show it'll be a lot higher in the NASDAQ and some other sectors. This is incredible. And again, this is an incredible buy opportunity. Anytime, kind of like 87, you can get near the bottom of this channel. That's where you want to buy. And of course, that's never where anybody wants to buy. That's why you need tools like this to help. And we go to something more important. Where are we on this new economy cycle? Everybody's saying, oh, there's not really a new economy. No, this is wrong. There is definitely a new economy. We had a new economy emerge. They emerge every other generation, every 80 years. Every other generation is radical and very creative when they're young. They react to their boring parents, the Bob Hope type generations. And they bring radical new technologies, lifestyles, social trends that form the basis of the new economy, as I said earlier. The last new economy, the inventions that drove it came in the late 1800s. The boom that brought it in was from around 1900 to 1929, the growth boom, much like this one. It was cars, it was electricity, electrical appliances, phones, airplanes, I mean, you name it, steel beam construction. I could go on and on and on. It was new lifestyles moving to suburbia, out of cities, you know, a whole new economy emerged. The education of the average person at that time in 1900 was, you know, 2% went to college, 13% went to high school. Only 10% of people had flush toilets. We did not have any of the appliances and cars and things and phones we have today. Life definitely changed. There was a new economy, new business models, everything emerged along the way. So first thing is every 80 years a new economy emerges, and we're moving from standardization to customization and hierarchies to networks. And again, we could go on and on with the paradigm shifts, but they are real paradigm shifts and they are powerful. Now, the industry life cycle. Another key tool we use is something we call the S-curve. It's how new technologies, new trends, new lifestyles, new products move into society. They move very slowly into niche markets in an innovation phase as they go from 0 to 10% penetration, and then it accelerates. That's why they call it an S. It accelerates from 10% to 90% very rapidly, and then, of course, decelerates from 90 to 100. Most of the growth happens, obviously, in this middle phase. So it's important to understand that new trends, new products, new technologies do not move in a straight line, and that's what most people think they do. This is also why we always greatly overestimate the impact of new technologies in the early stages, and just as they're about to explode in the mainstream, we underestimate their impact. So when we look at this new economy cycle, there's clusters of new technologies that emerge together, again, like cars and phones and electrical appliances. And now we have computers and PCs and wireless phones and operating systems and internet and on and on and on. Clusters of technology that kind of move together to form the basis of a new economy. And the S-curve will show you how basically they emerge. Now I'm going to step back for a quick minute and review the auto industry as the proxy for what happened back in the last economy. The automobiles were invented in 1886. They didn't commercialize, start building in decent-sized lots, you know, corporations, until 1900. There was a startup boom. If you follow this industry life cycle, the innovation phase, 1904 to 1908, when a lot of new brands emerged and the Model T emerged as a standard model for cars, then you saw a growth boom. All these new brands grew rapidly from 1908 into 1919. There was an incredible tech boom, just like we've seen in the 90s here. And in 1919, that peaked. And there was a huge shakeout. A lot of car companies and technology companies went under in the early 20s, a 1920 to 21 crash. But there's a shakeout right in the middle. We really start to accelerate as we go from 10% to 90, but as we get toward that 50% point, growth starts to slow a bit, and in human nature, business nature, is to overexpand, overinvest. So there's excess capacity, growth starts to slow, even though it's still rapid, and you get a shakeout, and many companies go under. Now, that's part of the cycle. We need many companies to innovate and test new things, but we only need a few to succeed to have the economies of scale to give us the lowest prices and best service. So you get this race for leadership. And of course, it finalizes in the maturity boom as the technologies then get out of the shakeout phase and move from 50 to 90% penetration. That's when you really see technology slow down for a long period of time. That's when the technology revolution's over, not the shakeout in the middle. That's where we are. In 1920-21, cars were hitting 50% penetration, just like a lot of other key technologies. Today, the internet, home computing, wireless and cellular phones are all at 50% penetration rates, and we've seen a correction coming into this, a shakeout. The point is we still have the 50 to 90% rapid penetration to grow. The technology revolution is not over either, and that's important to understand. Technology is a place where we'll show we can get 35 to 40-some percent returns buying in this time frame if you understand that the technology boom's not over. So, the auto index, our best proxy for the NASDAQ today. We didn't have a NASDAQ back then, and when this correction happens, well, one thing we always do, when something happens like the terrorist crisis, we go back 40 years and say, you know what, there was a Cuban Missile Crisis. Then we go back in 80 years and we say, God, there was the first modern terrorist event, a bomb on Wall Street, J.P. Morgan in 1921. I mean, we look back and see if there's something similar in the cycle. So we did that with this crash, and we had to really dig, because there were no tech indexes like the NASDAQ. So we found the auto index and tire and rubber. And what you see here is in 1920-21, about the same time frame of this crash, a two-year downturn, 70% correction in auto stocks, 72% in tire and rubber. A major crash, a tech wreck. The Dow was down 45% more than today. We had a recession stronger than today. But, of course, we recovered from that, and by 1922, the stock market was growing again, the economies were growing again, and most people know what happened then, the Roaring Twenties. The final phase of the tech boom, the peak spending of the Henry Ford generation, created the best decade for stocks in history and created the buy opportunity of the whole last century. Buying in late 21 in that crash, with the type of gains that came in the Roaring Twenties to follow, would have given an investor the highest average annual returns of any time in the last century, better than the 50s and 60s, better than the 80s, even better than the 90s. That's why we call this, we'll explain, the buy opportunity of a lifetime today. We've got the same thing happening again on an 80-year cycle. Now, what happened to the auto index from 22 to 29? It went up 12 times in 7 years. 12 times. That was an average annual gain. Average annual compound return on your investment of 44%. Now, General Motors, one of the leading car companies, was down 75%, just like Cisco or EMC or major tech companies in this correction. General Motors went up 22 times, an average annual compound return of 57% from 22 to 29. So the reason I'm emphasizing this, back in the early 20s, we saw a bubble in tech stocks. Price-earnings ratios got almost as high as they did in 1929. There was a huge crash, and to everybody looking back then, they would have been saying the same things today. The bubble's over, the tech revolution's over, the stock market's over. We got to get used to lower returns in a slow-growth economy, and instead we got the Roaring Twenties. That's why it's important not only to understand demographics, but the stages of this new economy cycle, how the S-curve works. We can always know exactly where we're on the S-curve, where we are on this 80-year cycle, where we are in our 40-year boom cycle, and we don't have to be confused like everybody else, and people are confused today. So again, we see the same thing happening here. We just saw a little over 70% correction in the NASDAQ, leading major brand name tech leaders down anywhere from 60 to 80 to 90%. And this is the buy opportunity, not just for the Dow and broad stock market and the growth stocks that did so well, but particularly in tech stocks. It's important to remember here, once the S-curve clicks in, and it really started to click in the early to mid-90s, once the S-curve clicks in, you get this incredible race for leadership, particularly in tech stocks, but in all the new growth sectors, and it narrows down to fewer and fewer leaders. So large cap growth stocks do the best. And the sectors that are leveraged by technology and the sectors that are leveraged by the most powerful spending cycles of the new generation, like financial services in the last decade because the investment cycle, the baby boom, is kicking in, healthcare as we age, travel and leisure, upscale retail as we get older and are willing to pay for high quality, these things do very well. We also note around the world, when we look at the world demographic scene, Asia, if you take out Japan, Japan has still a slow economy for many years to come by our forecast, but Hong Kong, Singapore, China, Korea, Taiwan, the developed countries in Asia have the strongest demographics in the world and have the best diversification to a U.S. portfolio. So what we've been recommending, particularly in the Roaring 2000s investor book, is that while we're in this growth stage of the boom, and particularly now in this correction, where the strong growth sectors have been so beaten down and undervalued, the best sectors to be in a portfolio, both for growth and diversification, are technology, financial services, healthcare, and Asia ex-Japan. And the large cap have had better returns and lower risk than small caps because the boom's favoring this in the race for leadership. Now, small caps will do better because we have a 23-year lag we use for that, and starting in 99, the echo baby boom is creating an innovation cycle favoring small caps again. But you have to remember, the baby boom trend is even larger in numbers, and we've had such an extreme correction in large cap growth stocks that it tends to favor them. So we're saying get back in these sectors, diversify in these sectors, don't have all your money in just technology. You can always add bonds, long-term, particularly corporate bonds, if you want to bring down the risk and add income. But this is the way we see building portfolios. We don't see one investment strategy working over the 80-year cycle or your own life cycle. Growth, large cap growth stocks are the most favored in this boom. High quality corporate bonds will be the most favored sector in the downturn, along with Asia. So the investments will switch. And if you look back at the last season, the 70s, long-term bonds, which had done well due to disinflation, and large cap growth stocks got hammered. Small caps did well. Japan did well. Third world countries did well. Real estate with inflation did well, particularly the commercial sectors being favored by the baby boomers. So again, there's always something booming. But our cycles say it's back to large cap growth. Right when all the experts are saying, nope, go to value, go to bond, go to small cap, large cap growth is going to reign for this next 50 to 90S curve and the peaking of this race for leadership. So that's where we specifically recommend investing. Now, if we look at our projections for the NASDAQ, because this is where the strongest opportunities are, just after everybody is soured on tech stocks. We don't have as neat a channel as we do for the Dow here, but what we see are two things. A fundamental trend up the middle, which would point to a fair value of NASDAQ at about 3,000 now, much higher than it is, taking out the whole bubble, and a fair value at the top around 2008 or 9 of around 12,000 or so. Our range of forecasts for the NASDAQ, and we use a lot of other methods, technical methods of measuring the size of these different waves and et cetera, but our range is 16 to 20,000. At a 16,000 NASDAQ, buying from the bottom here recently would give you a 37% average annual return. At 20,000, which I actually think is more likely, 43%. Now imagine some of the leading stocks, whoever the leaders end up being, Cisco's, et cetera, could be much higher than that, like General Motors. So this is where we see the strongest returns. I mean, the NASDAQ could literally go up 10 to 12 times. In fact, that would be very consistent with what the auto index did in the same time period back in the same part of the cycle 80 years ago. That's our basic forecast. And just to kind of summarize here, we look at the near term. We also do a lot of cycle work. We've gone back and found 4, 8-year, 10-year, and 14-year cycles. These four cycles explain every major correction in the stock market for the last 40, 50 years, the only exception was 1984, pull back off of the bottom in 82. The 14-year cycle has to do with these technology corrections and consolidations. The 10-year, we call it the decade hangover cycle. Every decade, some sectors boom strongly, overexpand, and then it's the early years of the next decade, like the early 80s, early 90s, early 2000s, where we tend to have these consolidations and clean that up. And the stock market usually anticipates that in the first year. And we also have 4 and 8 year political cycles. Every 4 years, we've had a minor correction back for decades and decades, between typically May and September. Every 8 years, the cycle is much worse, like 74, 82, 90, and 98. So we think this pullback here near term is a minor buy opportunity, but we see for people who missed the late September of 2001 buy opportunity, we think we're going to get another chance in the fall of this year once we see a pullback from this rebound. The only cycle we have, much like in the late 90s when the stock market was so good, we see the stock market really catching fire again in 2003. 2003 will be one of the strongest years, particularly for tech stocks and biotech and financial services, all the sectors we like. We don't really have a significant cycle hitting until mid to late 2006, where we think we'll see a 98-like correction that'll be stronger than average, but then we'll turn around and see the final bubble in 2007, 2008, somewhere in that time frame, much like we did in 99 and early 2000. So that's kind of how we see this scenario playing out. In the mid to late parts of years like 2002, 2006, you can get more defensive, more into value funds to protect yourself. But basically, we recommend being back in these growth sectors strongly, particularly by, say, September or October of this year. And again, I think we may see just as great a buy opportunity as we saw in late September 2001 for people who are patient. So that's a summary. I'm happy now to handle, you know, whatever questions come up. And let me see if I've got anything here. Okay. Is it still the best strategy to be fully invested in this market, or should I be selling some of my portfolio to cash? You know, there's a short and long-term issue here. For somebody who's a long-term investor, you know, you could be in technology, biotech, healthcare, financial services, Asia, areas like that. You could salt away for now and just basically hold it for 7 or 8 years before you have to change your strategy. Another thing we advise doing, in addition to diversifying in the best sectors that are being favored, is what's called dynamic rebalancing. When you get towards the top of this Dow channel, or when any sector does incredibly well for 2 or 3 years, then you lighten up on that sector and you buy more of the sectors in your portfolio that haven't done so well. In early 2000, we were advising, because we generally advise people to stay invested and not try to jump in and out of the market. There's too many tax implications, and it's too easy to mess it up. We simply said, cut back your technology, biotech, and Asia, which had done so incredibly well, and emphasize and increase your healthcare and financial service. Well, healthcare actually went to new highs, and financial services did very well overall in the correction. So that's one way to do it, and of course now would be the opposite. Now we've seen an extreme correction. We buy the sectors that have been hit the hardest. We are favoring weighting our portfolios much more heavily towards technology, biotech, and Asia right now, and we are de-emphasizing financial services and healthcare. So that's some general advice. It depends on your investment strategy. That's part of the thing. If one has invested in the large cap stocks, Intel, Qualcomm, EMC, Oracle, Microsoft, Cisco, again, many of which are down 70% plus, would you recommend holding them? Yes. These are definitely the stocks to be back in. As a general rule, what we're telling people, because of the S-curve and because of the stage we're in, that the very types of sectors and the very types of stocks that did so well in the mid to late 90s boom, large cap growth stocks, technology leaders, these are going to be the companies going to dominate again. So we do not recommend going back to value or small cap or some other sectors. We think the same type of companies lead. Now, there might be some companies that lag, but the general sectors, and if you buy these type of mutual funds and stocks, that is the place to be. Our major advice is you really want to be aggressively in these type of stocks and sectors, because again, we think 2003 is going to be a very, very strong year coming out of this major correction and coming out of this short-term cycle in mid to late 2002. This is going to be the last question, and it's a good one. Where can I learn more, which books, etc.? First thing, let me remind people, we have a website, hsdent.com. You can go on there. We have a lot of one-page reports on different topics, just like inflation we just talked about and stuff. We have a lot of special reports that we do. We have the buy opportunity of a lifetime on there, a 20-page report that really goes more into depth what I talked about today, why this crash, the parallels of the early 20s. And we have our newsletter. People can get a free sample. You can get off of the website and get a feeling for that. We come out with a large edition every 3 months, anywhere from an 8 to 12-page edition. Then we have a short update, 2 to 3 pages, the months in between. What we really do in the newsletter, in addition to commenting on, you know, portfolio strategies and key trends, we update people on our research. I mean, we have another book coming out. Well, the people in our newsletter have gotten all the research and updates and trends, you know, over the last 2 years that people will only see in that book. So I consider the newsletter the most important tool for keeping up with what we do. Now, as far as books, the books are different. The Roaring 2000s is best for business trends. It has the broadest look at trends. I mean, real estate trends, population migration, changes in corporations. We take the broadest view. So for somebody who's looking for something in their business, I'd say the Roaring 2000s. If you're looking for investment and investment strategies and how to build portfolios, the Roaring 2000s investor is totally focused on that. And this next book is really going to be more general again, like the Roaring 2000s, and look at everything, philanthropy as well, starting your own foundation, things like that. So all the books are a bit different, but that's the main differentiation. I don't recommend The Great Boom Ahead, because it's too old. It came out in 92. But the Roaring 2000s for business, and particularly for people into real estate and then for people into stock and mutual fund investing, the Roaring 2000s Investor is the best book. So again, thank you for tuning in. This ends our Mastery Coaching today. Best of success to you in the Roaring 2000s.
This is Tony Robbins. I thought I'd read something to you that I found very interesting. This was reported in the Times of London just a few weeks ago, June 6th. You know, all the ethics upsets have created a series of studies being done on accounting and about wealthy people and the mindsets of how they truly operate. And so a brand new study has just come out from Texas A&M, and part of that study, they tracked the fortunes of a series of people who attended a very famous meeting at the Edgewater Hotel in Chicago in 1923. Among them at the time were 8 of the world's richest men of the time. And they want to track what happened to their lives. So they track the history of their lives. So listen to this and think of this in terms of all that we've been talking about here. And here's what it says. It says, in 1923, a very important meeting was held at the Edgewater Hotel in Chicago. Attending this meeting were 9, actually, of the richest men in the world. Number one was Charles Schwab, president of the world's largest independent steel company. 2 was Samuel Insull, president of the world's largest utility company. 3rd was Howard Hobson, president of the largest gas firm in the world. 4th was Arthur Cutten, C-U-T-T-E-N, the greatest wheat speculator in the world. 5 was Richard Whitney, president of the New York Stock Exchange at the time. 6th was Albert Fall, a member of the president's cabinet. 7th was Leon Frazier, president of the Bank of International Settlements. And 8th was Jesse Livermore, the greatest speculator in the stock market. And 9th was Ivor Kruger, head of the company with the most widely distributed securities in the world. This is 1923. So it's early in the Roaring 20s. Here's what's interesting. They found they followed their lives. 25 years later, number one, Charles Schwab had died in bankruptcy having lived on borrowed money for 5 years before his death. Number 2, Samuel Insull had died virtually penniless after spending some time as a fugitive from justice. 3rd, Howard Hobson was insane in an institution. 4, Arthur Cutten died overseas broke. 5, Richard Whitney had spent time in Sing Sing prison. 6, Albert Fall was released from prison so he could die at home. 7, this is 25 years later, Leon Frazier, nothing happened to Leon Frazier, they don't say anything about Leon Frazier. 8, Jesse Livermore, nothing about him. And 9, Ivor Kruger, who died by suicide. Measured by wealth and power, these men achieved success, at least temporarily, making lots of money as their acceptable goal, but most of these men assuredly did not guarantee a truly successful life. My question would be, how would you measure success? 95% of all investors lose money over a 10-year period of time, over 25 years. Very rarely are the people who are wealthy in the beginning still wealthy in the end. And there's a reason for it. When you start your own business, the very things that make you successful in your psychology are things like ignoring everybody else's opinion. Because if you listen to it, you would never succeed. Isn't it true? It's your willingness to just have unbelievable optimism in spite of every kind of challenge you can imagine. That's a big part of what brings something from an idea into reality. It's your relentless emotional belief and drive in whatever it is you're doing. Later in life, in a business, in its life, that same belief structure is what destroys a business. The things you're rewarded for in one stage of life, you're invariably challenged for in another stage of life. And those who don't adapt, which is the vast majority, usually have success for a period of time and lose it. How many people can you think of who have truly lasting success at all levels? Physical, mental, emotional, relationship, spiritual. I couldn't name a handful that I know of. I know some people today, and I've known some people for 10 or 15 years that fit in that category, and I think some people who probably will. But there aren't that many that really maintain that. So the thing you don't want to believe in is the illusion that change is something that's over once you've handled something, because the need of human beings for certainty is so high that we all want to get to that place where we don't have to do anything anymore, where it's like, okay, it's handled. Pick one area of success, economics. Some of you are set for life and you couldn't spend all that you got. Some of you are set for life as long as you don't spend too much of what you got. Some of you are not set for life, but you'd like to be. Some of you are driven to stretch yourself to be around people that are doing better, just to take the economics. But there's something you have to bring to the table, because it's not just financial, it's not just relationship, it's the emotional, it's all the different aspects of life. And that's making distinctions like, what does this mean? How could that affect? I'm always learning. Now, it's an old adage that's so overused, but the reason a phrase gets overused is usually because it's true. And that's that phrase, the road to success is always under construction. When you think you know it all, that's when you really are just beginning the process. And that's my experience of life and anybody I've seen who's really successful. So I thought we'd talk about, in the midst of all this discussion, is change. Because it's with us, it's not going to leave us, and it's going to intensify. In our history, in this 80 to 100-year cycle, there's another explosive change where society will never look the same. And what I mean by that, it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years. But it's going to be a bigger change in the next 10 years than is happening in your entire lifetime or the last 60 or 80 that you and or your parents probably ever knew. And it's a predictable change. When you create a change, that produces another problem. Because all changes create problems. So what do you got to do? You come up with another solution. And when you create up that solution, that's another change, which creates another problem. Now, when you look at the tempo of humanity and you see the tempo of change for the first several thousand years of recorded history, you know, that was something people could deal with psychologically. But now, through the use of technology, we are accelerating the number of changes in our biochemistry, in our physiology, in the pollution of our planet, in the creation of the ability to see, move, be able to shift our memories. All this is happening at a pace that's causing more problems faster and more solutions faster. But the technology we've developed right now is not keeping pace with the emotional skill sets and psychological skill sets of most people. And one of the reasons is because humans have this inherent need for certainty. We also need uncertainty. That's why we keep creating this change at this tempo. So it puts us in a little crazy making. So I thought change is an overused term. It's kind of like love is the way I try to describe it to people. It's like, you know, I love you. I love my dog and I love my wife. Okay? Are they the same experience? I hope not. And the point of the matter is, though, we do not make enough refined distinctions in language very often to be able to fully process what things mean to ourselves. And when we generalize, then what happens is we get general results, general understanding, and general pain, general worry. So think of change, instead of just everything is the same level of change, that there are different iterations of change. One iteration of change is changing something in a way that you think moves you forward. Change is automatic. You don't have to work on changing. Your body's going to change. Your relationships will change if you do nothing. Because as you enter stages of life, as you deal with different things, some of the people you love are going to die, or they're going to change their mindset, or the environment's going to change, and it's going to require them responding to that environment in a very different way. Because different life conditions require a different mindset. Is there a different mindset required in an environment where stocks go up no matter what you do, versus an environment where stocks seem to go down and know what you do, is an extreme example. Is there a different mindset needed when you lose a loved one than when day-to-day you're in a party environment? There's no question. If your life is going to have quality, a different life condition requires different levels of mindset. So change is automatic. Progress is not. Progress comes from conscious decision-making. And the more you are aware of how things really are, the more powerful your decision-making can be, and therefore the more powerful your life is, the more in control and shaping of your life you can be. The challenge is that most of us don't deal with reality. We deal with the reality we want, which very often, by the way, is the reality we say we don't want. Because the reality we say we don't want, like the problem we have, the reason people have their problem is because it meets their needs. And they say they don't want it, but another part of them does want it. And the reason the other part of them does want it is because it's convenient, it's easy, it meets the needs, it's got certainty to it. It doesn't require risks of one's entire sense of identity. So think about your mindset from here on, that change isn't just change. That if I want progress, I've got to consciously decide what I want, and I got to know how reality really is, not the way I've distorted it. Because when you and I interact with each other, and we meet anybody on the street, we experience all of our stories about a person like me and a person like you. Because in a matter of seconds, we do that. Or the stories of whatever our interactions have been up until now. And our stories are rarely totally accurate. They're generalizations like love, only worse, because instead of one word, we have whole paragraphs. And many of those paragraphs were written decades ago. So now we're reacting to our past experience of a thing we think is like you. And so the more we can get back to who you are, to what this moment is, to what's really going on here, instead of living in the past or running to the future, the more we can be present in this moment with the truth, the more we can make intelligent decisions that shape our destiny. So, thanks again for being with me. Remember to live with passion.